It's always an interesting symbol and one learns from everything. So the first thought that struck me was when the door was being closed, that we have to open. We are told we have to open, but open only to the mother, not to all kinds of noises and voices all around. And it's an interesting paradox, because very often when we shut our doors to everything else, it may look like we are narrowing. And how come this narrowing can lead to wideness, which is the goal of yoga? So it's very interesting, because it's not exactly a narrowing, but touching the key or the heart of creation. Now, once we touch the heart of creation or the key to creation, then automatically wideness follows, because wideness in the original sense is not simply an accumulation of information, facts, figures, forces, energies, but to climb from one tier to another. This is very interesting that the Vedas speak of wideness, but what they mean by wideness is not simply accommodating different points of views. That is, of course, one aspect. But the wideness that they speak of is ascension from physical to vital. So that's how the fullness comes. The Vedic path, the other day, someone asked me to speak on the Vedic path, and I was wondering, we have to speak again of an effort which was in way back. Of course, it's very interesting to see that effort and how it parallels with Shobhinder and the Mother's Yoga. But nevertheless, it's very interesting when we look at the path that the Vedic Rishis followed, that the path of wideness was that from the physical animal existence, they would rise to a vital existence, which was again vital fullness, the joy of life, the energy of life. From that, the next step of wideness was rising to the mental world. And from the mental world, to rise to the world which was beyond even the highest mental possibilities, beyond the mental heavens. And then still further, the fifth world or the fourth world, to the supramental world. So this was very interesting, that the path of wideness was not horizontal but a vertical ascension. And as one ascended vertically, one also automatically became wider and wider. And for that, the Vedic Rishis touched the key to creation in another way. We, of course, it has been made much simpler for us thanks to the Mother's grace. But the Vedic Rishis were not fortunate enough to have the grace of the Infinite Mother. So they had to ascend to that level. The path they followed was touching another key in creation, and that key is Agni. So Agni is called as Jatvedas, the knower of all births, because it is there in all that is there in creation. Everything that is created, Agni is present, because it is the divine will and the divine wisdom. It's very interesting, the image of Agni is the image of heat and light. So it is the power as well as the wisdom that is working in creation. It is another way to say the divine consciousness which is at the heart of all creation. But Agni is visualized in the Vedas. He or she or it is the divine will and the divine wisdom which is working. And constantly the Vedic Rishis invoke Agni to lead through the path of the right and the light towards the vastness, towards the truth. Now, this is one of the first very interesting things, that they also, the first effort in the Vedas was to touch that heart, to touch that core. And that's why one of the reflections that the Vedic Rishis ponder about is that we have to reach to the Deva. Now, Deva is not just any god. In the Vedic sense, the Deva is the infinite being. This is another very interesting thing, because there is a tendency when we speak of the divine as simply an impersonal consciousness. But the Vedic Rishis saw the divine not just as an impersonal consciousness, but as a conscious infinite being. So they had to reach that Deva. But that Deva is infinite and our state is finite. That Deva is illimitable and our state is a limited being. That Deva surpasses all conceptions, all that thought can weave, all that our human effort can lead us to. And we are here in this sphere of mortality. So how are we to reach that Deva, that infinite being, that infinite consciousness? So they were in search of that principle which can serve as a bridge. We have, of course, we are very fortunate to have the golden bridge, Shubhinder speaks of the mother as she is the golden bridge. And then in the same breath he says the wonderful fire. So it's very interesting that the Vedic rishis, they don't, because she has not incarnated as the divine mother in their midst, for that the Vedic rishis have to wait for maybe 10,000 years. Now they would be happy to see that she has incarnated in our midst. But at that point of time, they were invoking the fire, and they describe this fire in very interesting way. It has neither the head nor feet. So if one really reads some of these Vedic images, they can be very mind-boggling. So it doesn't have a head because it merges into the infinite. It extends into the infinite. It doesn't have a feet because it goes down into the, through the nether worlds, right into the densest darkness. So the Agni becomes the bridge between the state of darkness here and the state of light and knowledge above. The second interesting thing was that Vedic rishis had a glimpse of the supermind, but in a very different way. Now, each path has searched for some aspect or the other of the infinite, of the divine. He is infinite. And some aspect of the other, each path has. For instance, bhakti searches for the infinite bliss, beatitude, ananda and love and rapture that comes through love of the divine, sweetness of the divine. Then the path of knowledge searches for the true self and the knowledge in which the knower and the known become one. The path of works searches for the master of works, the will that is active in the cosmos. Vedic rishis were in search of immortality. Whereas in our yoga, we search for perfection. It's very interesting that the two terms. Now, immortality, when the Vedic rishis went in search of immortality, they found that everything that is within limitations is mortal. So to start with, we know that physical body is mortal. Then we discover that our feelings are mortal. In the sense, today we have one kind of feelings and tomorrow we will have another kind of feelings. And it's a very interesting meditation and very simple practical thing of life, that very often we flow in a certain current of feeling. And after a while we see that these feelings are either changing into something, ascending towards something more beautiful, or these feelings are dipping towards something else, but nevertheless they are changing. Now, if we follow the upward current, these feelings change and large and grow into something beautiful and divine. If we follow the downward current, they will gradually gravitate and disappear and vanish, leading to division and disintegration. So it's very interesting that they are changing. Similarly with thought. We hold on to a thought, but thought itself can have these two movements. A thought which starts from one point, goes deeper and upward like a flame ascending to heaven, till it widens into something not just beautiful, but something which is powerful. So much so that it can change things. That's how Shrivinda puts in Savitri. One lonely thought becomes omnipotent. Now, this is the power of thought. When we go deeper into anything, similarly with will, our will can ascend further or it can go down. But normally again, will is changing. Today I will one thing, tomorrow I will another thing. And at one point I will one thing in the morning. In the afternoon I am willing something else. At night something else. So will itself is not really following a path, but it is caught up in a maze and haze. So Vedic rishis were searching for a path that would lead to a limitless state of being, because they realized that as long as anything which is limited is prone to death. So mortality in the original sense of the Veda was not about shedding the body. It is understood. Body's death is one kind of mortality. But anything which is subject to limitation is bound to die. It may live for a short while, it may live for a long while. Certain thoughts and ideas have governed humanity through large spaces of time. But eventually they reach a point which is mortal, where they will meet a deadlock. And perhaps that is what is meant by the second coming and the return of an avatar. When Buddha says that after 500 years, there will be a return. Basically it means that whatever energy, the thought, the idea that has released in the world will act up to a given point of time. But beyond a certain point, this idea has to either enlarge or change into something else. Otherwise this idea would have become a spent force. Now, 2005 years is not an ordinary span of time. But the beauty of the Vedas is that the Vedas, because they were in search of a limitless condition of being, despite going through a period of, you know, cycles when the Vedas were lost. This is a whole history in itself, how the Vedas were lost and recovered. They were lost during the Upanishadic period because Upanishads tried to take up only the symbolic element of the Veda. They turned everything into an inner journey. So in Vedas we find both external and inner. So there is a whole external process, ritual, sacrifice, etc., which is external, which was meant for those who were not ready for the inner path. And there is a whole inner meaning to everything. The cow, the horse, the gritam, the rain, the soma, everything has an inner meaning, inner and outer at once. But Upanishads completely removed the outer meaning and turned it inner. Now, the problem of human mind is the moment you turn it inner, then it loses hold on the outer. And this Upanishad landed up with Vedanta. And the end of Vedanta was that there is one without a second and this world is an illusion. So, it's very interesting that following the trail of the Vedas, one came to a totally opposite philosophy and totally opposite conception of life, that all this is Maya, all this is ritual. Simply because one small fatal step was taken, and that step was to remove the outer aspects of the Vedas and keep only the symbolic inner meaning. This small step, Sri Aurobindo speaks about it. And of course, finally, Buddhism came and finished off whatever little was left. Then again Vedas return. They return. And then again they are lost. Then again they return. And finally we see that Sri Aurobindo in this cycle rescues the Veda again and puts a new meaning, the original sense of the Vedas. So we see in the Vedas there is a search for immortality. And in that search they found that unless we discover the limitless being, we cannot arrive at a state of immortality. Even the mental worlds, one can stay there. Heavens also have a term. That is the famous stories that when one goes to heaven and the Nachiketa himself is offered. This is a Upanishadic story that Nachiketa is offered the boon of the heavens. And Nachiketa says, okay, I will have all these things, death, but tell me, how long will you give them to me? 100 years, 1,000 years, so death is keeping silent, 10,000 years. Will it end one day? So death says yes, one day it is going to end. It cannot be limitless, it cannot be termless. So Nachiketa immediately asks him, give me that knowledge through which I can arrive at immortality. So again, immortality is about the limitless condition of being. Limited being is mortal. Limited mind, limited power of life, limited physical existence, limited sense of self is subjection to death. Whereas the one is infinite, infinite condition of being, infinite existence, infinite consciousness, infinite delight will never end. Now the Vedas found this path, but when they reached the upper limits of the mind, this is another interesting parallel, they found that they could leap into that and vanish. Now, it's very interesting that Vedic rishis were very realist. They were not illusionists. So they said, this is not fair because this not infinite condition of the being that we want, this not just the kind of immortality they want. So they went the other way, the reverse path. And in the reverse path, they started digging deep and deep and deep, 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 deep into matter. Now, when they went into matter, they found another kind of obstacles than when they were ascending. And this also we find in Sri Aurobindo's yoga. When we ascend, take the ascending path, when we ascend from mind to vital, vital to mental to higher mental worlds, higher mental world to the worlds of intuition and revelation, we find that we are offered resistance by the powers of light. So they help us, but they will not let us go beyond. So reason will help us to get to master and control our animal vitality. But reason becomes a barrier if it has to release us into the higher mind. Now the higher mind with its symbolic knowledge and the gods of the higher mind help us to understand this creation better. But they will not let go to release us into the intuitive mind. So these are powers of light which will not allow us. They will bind us somehow or the other. And they can bind us in fantastic ways. For instance, when we ascend to the higher mind or something still higher, there are so many revelations, so many things crowd upon the mind that sometimes one wants to put it into a form of a writing or speak about it. But a time comes when one discovers these very revelations are preventing one from identification. It's very interesting. Swami Vivekananda speaks about it. He says, all this has to be stopped. I can't help it. My mind is exploding with this. It's a light that the mind wants to express and express and express. And yet, this very revelations, if one allows just that play, then it can continue, and one cannot ascend to the next level. So there comes a time when one has to quieten the revelations and one enters into a state of identification. So this is one kind of obstacles, and the Vedas speak of it. They speak of the gods as helping in the journey, then they speak of the gods as hindering in the journey. So the mother has done a radical surgery. She has removed that obstacle completely. She says the age of religions is over and the world of the gods is no more required. She speaks about it. Because the Vedas use that path. The Vedic rishis did not have the great privilege, the tremendous grace that we have today, that we can directly turn to the source, the mother of all gods. They could not straight away, they invoke Aditi. But it's much later. First they invoke Indra, then they invoke, Agni, then they invoke Indra. So Indra acts from the higher minds, and then he clears the ground. Then after Indra has done the job, then they will invoke Varuna, then they will invoke Mitra, then they will invoke Bhag, Som, and so on and so forth. Long journey. And each of these gods will help them to a point, but they will not release beyond that point, because even gods quarrel. But in different ways they quarrel, not like us human beings. Of course, sometimes human beings quarrel like gods. But each god fashions an idea. So there would be two contrary ideas. And to take a practical example, how the gods can quarrel in a human mind, because they act upon the human mind through suggestions. We may have often wondered in life, if there is a choice between justice and mercy, which one should we choose? This is an interesting dilemma. On one side, justice is a godhead. Because after all, justice preserves the balance of the worlds. What is wrong, what is dark, needs to be, in a sense, meted out its fate. On the other side, there is the god of kindness and mercy. It says, doesn't matter. It is kindness and mercy which should rule. And the mother interestingly describes this. She says, when I was young, many of the mantras came to me. She says that she has traveled the Vedic path in her own way, beautiful way. So, because she has to cover that whole ground. So she says that one particular mantra came to me in French. And for 25 years it continued. Not an ordinary time. And that mantra was in French, I won't be able to pronounce it correctly, but in English the translation was, O Lord of kindness and mercy, O Lord of kindness and mercy, Lord of kindness and mercy. This continued. And then she says, now I know why it came. Because this helps in the ascension much more. Because if we invoke justice, that is why she says much later, my child, don't call justice. If justice comes, none of you will be able to stand. Because if I invoke justice, then I must be ready to face the trial. If I ask for justice, I should be the first one to present myself. So if we invoke Kali, first thing she will do is slay our ego. Not somebody else's ego. And it happens. We have life of Swami Vivekananda when he, towards the end, Sister Nivedita describes very beautifully. There is a book, The Master as I Saw Him. She says that towards the end of his physical existence, particularly last 2-3 years, he would get into the mood of inviting Kali. And he would sing songs. That I love you, mother the terrible, come, I love you as death, I love you as misery. Come death, come misery, come mother the terrible. He was invoking her. And no wonder, I mean he was invoking because his goal was to merge into that and he wanted to be freed from this trap in which he was caught up. And sure enough the mother came, but when she came, he lost his balance. Sister Nivedita says, since the time he started invoking Kali, we saw that his health became fragile and his nerves could no more bear after that. And within 2 years, a man as leonine and mighty as Swami Vivekananda could not bear the pressure and he left the body. Of course, it was his goal, so it is perfectly fine. And he had felt he had done what he had to do. But when we invoke a particular Godhead, that Godhead must first work within us. So we have to be very careful which aspect of the divine we are invoking. So the mother would invoke the Lord of kindness and mercy, because when we invoke kindness and mercy, then whatever our failings, there would be kindness and mercy. And constantly the kindness and mercy will be with us and carry us through it. If we invoke love, then constantly that sweetness, beatitude will be with us. So this was the path that the Vedic Rishis followed. But it's a long and tortuous path. Each God, kindness, God of kindness, will not shake hands with the God of justice. So a whole aspect of creation will be left. Whereas in the supramental creation, all these gods have to be harmonized. We cannot have only kindness, we cannot have only justice. They have to be harmonized. We cannot have only God of love, we cannot have only God of knowledge. They have to be harmonized. So this is the difficulty of that path. So the mother makes it very easy for us. When we turn to her, all these gods spontaneously start working and laboring within us. This was one particular difference. Then when they went down, there was another kind of obstacle. When we ascend, there is an obstacle from the gods. So they will give us all kinds of lures at that level. They will not let us go. So a person at the intellectual level will suddenly find all kinds of intellectual conceptions, tortuous, difficult, analytical, and he will enjoy it. And even write nice papers, not realizing that it's a play of the bright gods of the mind who are not allowing him to go further. And when he has thought that, okay, this will be the end, the last paper that I am writing, suddenly another paper will enter into the head. And again he will write. After a while, another thesis, another PhD, another PhD. This is the play. It will not allow it to go further. Whereas in the descending path, the obstacle comes from the forces of darkness and division. In the mind, one kind of division. In the vital, another kind of division. Division of heart, division of will, division of consciousness. In the physical body, another kind of division. And yet at each level, the division has to be cleared. So much so that the mother at one place says, when I was trying to clear the obstructions in the body, this division which was so prominent, my child had to struggle for so many years. She is saying the word so many years. Until I found and realized that every body is one single body. Then she could say that it does not matter whether it is realized in this body or some other body, because it is one body. I am reminded of another statement of Nalnida, which someone narrated to me personally. When he went to meet Nalnida along with his wife on his birthday, so Nalnida looked at him for a while and then he said, you know, your body, her body, this body, they are all one body. I suppose this is what is meant by the entry into the collective consciousness and working there. But they went still further. And when they started going deeper, again they found the path blocked. So when they started going up, they found the path blocked. The highest mental world, the overmind gods, will not release them into the supramental gnosis. And down below, there is the big block sitting, the subconscient, will not allow it to go further down, where again the supermind is concealed and involved. And the Vedic Rishis call that concealed sun in the matter as Marthand, the eighth sun of Aditi. Seven suns shine in the higher firmament, and one she has released into the earth. So he is the sun who is the outcast, and he is caught up in the forces of darkness. Maybe the story of Karna is in some way symbolic of this. And this eighth sun has to struggle out, battling with the forces of darkness. And it's only he who can finally come and be the victor. And then only the Vedic Rishis can fulfill the dream of immortality. So it was a wonderful dream, a beautiful document. This is not the first document. The mother and Sri Aurobindo both affirm that the Vedas were derived from an earlier tradition. And the Vedic path was also tried by the Kabbalah, the Jewish tradition, and also by the Chaldean tradition. So it is not that the only Vedas were trying this path. The Kabbalah tradition, which is around the same time, the Zoroastrians, which are even before the Vedas, they also tried this. imperfectly. But there is a tradition which goes even beyond it, which has no name, and the documents are lost. And the Vedas themselves mention about it in a very interesting way. The Vedas say, we want to follow the path of the forefathers. But they never mention who are these forefathers. So these are the forefathers who had attempted the path, but they could not. So we have August Rishi telling Lopamudra, how long we have to dig? We have dug so much into the subconscious. How much more? How much more? When this passage was read to the mother about August Rishi and Lopamudra digging into the subconscious, she simply says, she is silent. And afterwards she says something else, because she has dug and found that son. So we'll read a little bit of that aspect of the Vedic journey. The last aspect we will read from the mother. One, we know that the rishis found the supramental sun. They glimpsed it standing on the borders of the overmind. But they could not fully release their consciousness into that. They aspired for that light to come into them through the gods. So there was some deflection, some distortion. Through each godhead they would invoke that light, that knowledge into their mind, into their heart. This was their effort. The gods would help them to receive that light. But this is a second hand, because the gods cannot directly, they are not perfect channels. Whereas in 1956, the mother completely blew off that passage, opened the passage from above for that complete light to invade into her being. But she says something very interesting. What happened in 1956 is not everything. It is just a beginning. There are many other things to follow, which she speaks elsewhere. Then the other aspect of the Vedic journey, going down below and clearing the obstacle of the subconscious and the last rock of the inconscient. These two she accomplished. This was in 1959, when she gives that beautiful New Year message, that as she went down, 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 she struck upon an almighty spring. Now this is a very interesting backdrop to this message. She saw some student and teachers and people, of course, within us, all of us. And when she saw them, she said, they are not interested in anything beyond their little personal life. So mother was curious that why don't they want anything beyond their personal life? Why are they not interested in anything other than their little life? So, see the way divine works. If it was a human being, he would scold and give a big lecture on sadhana and say, you people are wasting your time. She didn't say anything. She went into their atmosphere. And she says, when I went into their atmosphere, she started feeling stifling, suffocating. Imagine that infinite consciousness entering into a narrow mind, into a small little mind, into pettiness, into selfishness. She says, as I went down, I felt more and more suffocated, more and more suffocated. But then she would not give up. She said, I wanted to see what is at the bottom, what is at the root. And she says, Shivinda has described it in the God's labor. Probably Shivinda was doing this in his own way with all of us, humanity. She goes down and down and down, and then she says, at the very bottom of the inconscient, I found an almighty spring. And that suddenly throws her up. And when she comes up, she sees it was vibrating with the seeds of the new world. And then she discovers that all this is simply a shadow, which will be replaced by that force which is gushing from within. And that spring she released. It is a very interesting double action. What Shubindo speaks of in the mother, a call from below, a fixed and unfailing call from below, and a supreme grace from above that answers. So she becomes the bridge, and she bridges the gap from both sides. On one side she opens the door of the beyond. So the whole effort of the Vedic journey comes to a grand culmination in one direction. But this is not enough. To facilitate the journey further, she opens also the doors from below, and thereby she becomes the golden bridge and the wonderful fire. So we read just a little bit of that. In fact, as a bridge, there are quite a few places where mother becomes the bridge. And This was her great and difficult role. One of the bridges she builds is when she was with Theo in Algeria, where she builds a bridge through the dark, vital world so that people who die, they don't have to get caught up in the difficult journey through the vital. So she built a wonderful bridge so that those who have little faith and aspiration will go through that. So this was one of the bridges she built. Then she builds a bridge between the rapture and the calm. This is how Sri Aurobindo describes her. The bridge between the peace of the infinite and the attraction of man towards that, and the rapture, which is the dance of the infinite in creation. So she builds a bridge. So henceforth creation can dance with Krishna without losing the peace and the calm that are at the backdrop. And finally she bridges the bridge between the wonder and the abyss. So she speaks of this very interestingly, this digging down and finally touching that. Truly speaking, perhaps one is never rid of the hostile forces as long as one has not permanently immersed into the light. There the term hostile forces loses its meaning. They become only forces of progress. They force you to progress. But to see things in this way, you have to get out of the lower hemisphere. For below they are very real in their opposition to the divine plan. So it's very interesting. If you look at things from the larger and divine point of view, they are no hostile forces. They are simply forces of progress. It's very interesting because these both conspire towards one great end. It was said in the ancient traditions that one could not live for more than 20 days in this higher state without leaving one's body and returning to the supreme origin. This has been said by Sri Ramakrishna. This has been said by Sri Raman Maharishi. It is documented very well. But Mother says something very interesting. Now this is no longer true. This is called divine humility. She is not saying that I am able to do it. She is simply saying now this is no longer true. It is precisely this state of perfect harmony beyond all attacks that will become possible with the supramental realization. It is what all those who are destined for the supramental transformation will realize. The hostile forces know it well. In the supramental world, they will automatically disappear. Having no further utility, they will be dissolved without our having to do anything, simply through the presence of the supramental force. So she is also giving us a key. Our mind should not be occupied with hostile force. Everybody who falls ill is an attack of hostile force. Everything that happens contrary to my wish is an attack of hostile force. Our concentration has to be on the supramental force and not on the hostile force. So by its very presence, invocation and pressure, it will be dissolved. So now they are being unleashed with a fury in a negation of everything. The link between the two worlds has not yet been built, but it is in the process of being built. This was the meaning of the experience of February 3rd, 58, to build a link between the two worlds. So this is the experience of the supramental boat, where she builds a bridge between this world and the other. For both worlds are indeed there, not one above the other, but within each other. So this is one world she's built. Now the disciple asked this question, what is the relationship between this experience and that of November 7th? This is the experience of the Almighty Spring, which he gives in the New Year message. In what is what you found in the depths of the inconscient this same supramental? So Mother says, the experience of November 7th was a further step in the building of the link between the two worlds. So we celebrate, of course, 1956, 29th February, and it's very beautiful, but there are so many celebrations which have followed it. The Superman consciousness, the Almighty Spring, we don't even talk about it, because this was as important, perhaps a more important step in the evolutionary journey. She says it was a further step, where I was cast, was clearly into the origin of the supramental creation. In fact, she says it was the shorter route, because it is within matter. It is the shorter route, she says, not the one which goes through the ascension. All this warm gold, this tremendous living power, she is describing now this. This sovereign peace. And once again I saw that the values governing the supramental world have nothing to do with our values here. The same thing she discovers in the February 3rd experience. She says, I discovered that the values here have nothing to do with the values there. And then she was asked, what do you mean by that? She says, all that man has regarded as important, as interesting, as spiritual, it has nothing to do with what the supramental world sees. And then she was asked, Mother, please tell us, what are those values? And she describes, of course, a couple of them. We'll talk about it later someday. In fact, we had probably a class on that. So she says, again I saw when I went down that the values which that is looking for are different. Even the values of our highest wisdom, even those we consider the most divine when we live constantly in a divine presence, it is utterly different. She says even things, so challenging is this idea that even things which we regard as constantly living in the divine presence, they are different from what those values are in the supramental creation whose seeds are there within. Not only, then she is making it still elaborate, not only in our state of adoration and surrender to the Supreme, but even in our state of identification, the quality of the identification is different depending upon whether we are on this side, progressing in this hemisphere, or the other hemisphere, the higher hemisphere. And this we find very interestingly in the synthesis of yoga. Every mystic has identified with some aspect of the divine, and he has described it or tried to describe it. But we feel something is different about Sri Aurobindo. He also speaks of identification with the Supreme. The mother also is identified with the divine. What is the difference? We cannot fathom. Because to be identified with the divine while still the consciousness is on the mental and one takes a leap is different than identifying with the divine taking a supramental station. So she says that itself is different. The quality or the kind of relation I had with the Supreme at that moment was entirely different from the one we have here. Even the identification has a different quality. Here, we have reached the end, the summit, but it's a quality that is different. The quality in the sense that a fullness, a richness, a power is there. But there is a something that eludes us. It's truly a new reversal of consciousness. And then she tries to put it in words, and she says that these words are poor in comparison with the splendor. And then she says, finally, something very interesting. It was only the surface of things. She is describing what is the surface of things? The splendor, the whole spiritual life. The whole spiritual life of the psychic being and of all our present consciousness that appears so warm, so full, so wonderful, so luminous to the ordinary consciousness. Well, all this splendor seems poor in comparison to the splendor of the new world. So it's very good to remember so that we don't stop at anything, at a beautiful psychic realization or nice experiences of the spiritual kind. She says, all this appears poor. It was only the surface of things, the surface of the experience. Behind the surface, there is a depth, and only when one enters into this depth does one touch the true thing. And it is the same experience each time. A surface with all that it entails of inaccuracy, an artificial transcription. It feels like something not really alive. You step into another zone and you feel you have uncovered the source and the power and the truth of things. So what are we to do? This is, she is saying, even the psychic and spiritual life are nothing compared to that. So she says, there is night and sun, night and sun, and night again. Many nights, but one must cling to this will for surrender. cling as through a storm and put everything into the hands of the Supreme Lord until the day when the sun shall shine forever, the day of total victory. I think there is one more small little thing. If I can find it. Yes. So she says one way is the surrender to the Supreme Lord in everything, in every way, and it will take you to the ultimate sun and the victory. The second process he gives, so Vedic in its method, widen yourself as far as the extreme bounds of the universe and beyond. Take upon yourself always all the necessities of progress and dissolve them in the ecstasy of unity. Then you will be divine. So this is the wide path, starting from the path of the Vedas and ending with the creation of the supramental world.